When we come to the final section, speaking of metta meditation and the course of this practice, and throughout this series of talks, I've tried my best to convey in some way the essence and the experience of what metta meditation can be. But of course these words fall drastically short of what they're trying to describe. And one can never hope to fully capture or express the richness or the resonance of something, a spiritual practice that's as profound as meditation is. And the course and the reality that the meditation follows will inevitably differ greatly for each person. And it's very obvious once we've hung around in meditation circles for a little while and speaking to different people about their practice that everybody's responses to meditation will be exceedingly variable, and there's no possible way that one blanket application of one particular technique will work for everybody. So when we're doing our own practice, we need to always focus back on what are the core issues, not trying to measure ourselves against some kind of external standard, whether that be the progress along some meditation technique or reaching what we imagine to be various stages of samadhi or something, or making ourselves sit for certain periods of time or anything like that. We need to remember what is the purpose of the meditation: to overcome the defilements within our own heart, to expand our own capacity for knowing, for understanding, for compassion, for challenging and uprooting our own sense of who we are, and bringing that into a context that's broader than we could have imagined. So most of the time up until now I've been speaking of how to develop those beautiful and exalted states of consciousness that we call samadhi. And as you well know, according to Buddhism, that such things are not by no means the end of the path. They are an essential means, an essential aspect of the journey, but not the ending of it. And the reason I emphasize these things so much, firstly because they're very often de-emphasized in modern meditation teachings, secondly because I think in a modern society that development of peaceful and happy states of mind is probably the most crucial thing that we can do, and I think that we're most lacking. And thirdly, because I think that's where most people are at in their path, that's where most people need to develop. But when it's all over, the mind comes out of samadhi, whatever kind of level that is, whether it's true samadhi in jhanas, or whether one's developed a nimitta to one degree or another, or even perhaps if one's just developed a degree of peace of mind, then it's useful to use that period of time for developing what we call vipassana or insight meditation. Vipassana happens at a number of different levels, a number of different aspects, all of which are good, all of which we can do and are part of the path. At the preliminary or initial stage, it's simply the development of right view. And so we investigate our understanding of Dhamma, our ideas about Dhamma, study the texts, question them, interrogate them, see how this is going to shape our understanding or whatever. And by doing so, we tend to loosen some of the kind of ideological chains that we tend to bind the way that we see the world up in. And we begin to see the world in a kind of a broader or more meaningful way, patterns start to emerge. So a second level or aspect of vipassana that we can do is using the concepts and ideas about Dhamma that we have consciously to provide some framework for our meditation. So in the same way that we, for example, if we want to do metta meditation, we take up the idea of metta and we try to use that thought of metta to sort of get leverage into the experience of the reality of metta. The same way when we're developing vipassana, we can use, you know, the kind of ideas like, say, the five aggregates or the six sense bases or the four elements or dependent origination. And we can use these ideas as ways into understanding our own experience. And of course there are many different ways of doing this. And the Buddha clarified this in the simile of the Kingsuka tree, the what is it tree. And you know, a fellow went to ask one monk, what about, how do you develop insight? And he said, oh, well, it's when you understand the five aggregates. And he went to see somebody else and said, well, how do you develop insight? And he said, it's how you understand the six sense bases. And he went to see someone else and he said, it's how you understand the four elements. Someone else said, it depends on how you understand impermanence. And someone says, it depends on how you understand four noble truths. And he went to the Buddha and complained, how come everybody's teaching something different? And the Buddha just said, well, they're all explaining it according to the way that they saw it, according to how the truth manifested to them. So this is something where there isn't just one right way. Just as with developing samatha meditation, there's no one right object. There's many different ways that you can develop peace of mind. Metta that we've been discussing is just one of them. And same with developing insight, that one can use a particular framework, something that one finds intriguing or meaningful, and then use that as a way of bringing oneself into contact with one's own experience. Now, when we do this, then there are two major stages, I guess, or two or three major stages in doing this. I'm not going to describe or attempt to describe the course of insight in great detail, which you'll find in the textbooks. I don't think it usually happens in that way. But there are a couple of things which are useful to understand in terms of the progress of it. And so if we choose one particular framework, say the six senses, and we begin to investigate in terms of those six senses. And so we can spend some time with each of the six kinds of consciousness or fields of awareness or experience that arise at each of those six senses. And so you just spend some time with the eye and the eyes and just noticing what that's like. And just reflecting on or considering the actual physical eyes, the eyeball sitting there, both as an idea and also as an experience. How do you actually experience them physically? And then the external field of awareness, the light and whatever kind of stimuli that one has. And then the relationship between those two things giving rise to the eye consciousness when all of those things come together. And so you can just kind of see these things, and then of course you can see your reaction or response to that. And then you can go from there and consider the same way the ear and the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. Each of them in a way as it is. Okay? Just as the thing itself. And one can also compare one to the other. So it's getting an idea of the differences between them, the different, totally different flavor that each sense has to each other. So this is like one stage of insight meditation. Next stage or next aspect of it is seeing the, what we call the tilakana or the three characteristics. And so typically the idea is basically that you first of all get an idea, get well established in understanding what the thing is itself. then when you do that, then you get an idea of the impermanence of it, or the suffering of it, or the not-self of it. And again, typically, or the emptiness, as I've sometimes used. So again, typically, you can choose at this stage one or other of those characteristics and use them, use that as a means of investigating. Okay? So you choose anicca or dukkha or anatta, or if you like to use emptiness, and investigate in those, in that term, reflect on your experience and kind of deepen your experience there. And the third stage, if you like, is the abandoning or going beyond, which is like the stage of realization of those things, which kind of happens as a natural outcome of that process. So there's like this experience or the practice of vipassana can be broken up in this way, and we can choose to do it in different formats, using different avenues, different perspectives. And that's one way of doing it. When we come to a deeper level, then, especially after the mind has had some good samadhi, and when you're pull out of the samadhi and mind's reflecting on that, then often there's no need to do anything. Okay? And so this is much more like vipassana as a kind of just mindful awareness practice. Now, we talked about this mindful awareness as a starter practice, like right at the beginning of our meditation, we've been doing just mindful awareness, just watching whatever comes and goes and remaining mindful of it. And that's happening at a fairly shallow level. But now we can do the same thing, and it happens at a much deeper level with the purity of consciousness. And so we'll notice, first of all, the most striking thing that we'll notice is that there's much less happening. The mind is much deeper, and the actual stuff that arises and comes through the mind is much less of it. The mind's much quieter. And so because the mind's so much less crowded, there's much less going on, then we can see the individual objects with tremendous clarity. So we can focus on each individual object with a tremendous degree of accuracy and see exactly as they're arising and staying and passing away. And that becomes, it's quite startling. And so you start to realize that those things which were quite ordinary, like the idea of impermanence, things rising and passing away, it's a very ordinary idea. But it starts to manifest to the mind in a way that's very naked. It's starting to like open itself up directly in a way to the roots of consciousness. And so that can cause some very strong reactions. Very commonly, the mind will be repulsed from that. Right? It's like that knowledge is too much. You know, it's like if we whatever, you turn on the telly and there's a picture of a car accident and there's somebody's headless corpse lying on the pavement or something like that, on the news or whatever it is. And you kind of have this kind of repulsion, it's too much to take. Yeah, and the same thing happens with this level of insight, is that the nakedness of the impermanence of things is often quite shocking at certain stages. And so you can have this feeling of shock or a feeling of fear, turning away, not wanting to see it. So at that time, you need a lot of equanimity. And this is where the steadiness and equanimity with which you've developed your samatha meditation really comes in handy, because you're able to take in those hard facts. Okay? And this is one of the great benefits of samatha meditation. It allows you not only to see the truth, but also allows you to actually encompass it, to actually be able to accept it without freaking out, without going mad. Yeah? And so these are things that can happen if you try to take your insight too deeply, too quickly, in a way that's unbalanced and extreme, then you can, unhinge your mind. You're looking into the the vortexes of reality, and a vortex of consciousness, and the floor drops out from under your sense of being, and you look down there and you think, whoa, I'm going to fall down there and get sucked in and mashed up. And it's true, you are going to get sucked in and mashed up. So you're actually seeing the truth, but you can't handle it. Okay? And so that can happen if you're not ready, if your mind's not developed properly, and if you meditate too extremely, too hard, too quickly. So if you have that equanimity and that kind of bigness of heart, then the mind can just open up to these things and the truth manifests without you necessarily trying to do anything about it or wanting to react in any way. And so that kind of process, as the process of insight deepens, then one's perception will change in kind of strange or unexpected or unusual ways. And again, this is very individual. Different people will respond differently to these things. And these changes in perception can be understood as the mind's grappling to see in a new way. The mind's grappling to interpret and understand experience through a completely different set of perspectives. And so it takes time to digest that and time to make sense of it. And so, you know, there comes a certain stage when kind of the truth happens. And this is not something which can be predicted. It's not something that can be programmed. It's not something anybody can promise you. You know, do a retreat for 3 weeks or something like that and you've got an 80% chance of getting stream entry. You know, this is not reasonable. It just happens sometime. Usually, of course, when you're least expecting it. And many, many stories, both in the past and also present day stories of monks and nuns who realize the time of enlightenment at the time you'd least expect them to, when they're just pouring out the bowl washing water or just turning off the lamp, or like a Venerable Ananda just going to sleep. And you know, there are many stories in the present day also of monks who have had similar experiences. In fact, it seems perhaps most normal that these kinds of experiences, enlightenment experiences, don't happen when you're in meditation. I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly seems to be the case from kind of anecdotal evidence that it's more likely to happen some other time, not necessarily when you're in formal meditation. And of course, is one of these great things which works, I think, by analogy with what we know usually as the Eureka moment. And of course, Archimedes leaping up out of his bathtub shouting out, "Eureka, I found it." And sometimes when the mind is prepared, the work is done, and then it just makes the connections. The mind makes its connections without you being too involved in it. And it seems very much from the way these enlightenment experiences are described in the texts and in the experiences that this is the kind of thing that it is. It happens. The world turns upside down. Everything explodes. The world that you knew just isn't there anymore. Part of you just drops off. Part of you turn around and it's just not there anymore. Something which was so familiar that you'd never even questioned its existence. And then you turn around and where is it? It's just not there. It was so familiar, I hadn't even known that it was there before. But now I know it's gone. And so we can't program or force this kind of experience, but through preparing our mind in the right way, we create the conditions whereby these kinds of things can happen. And we prepare our mind by these things I've been talking about, through doing the samatha meditation and developing samadhi, through developing our right view and our understanding of Dhamma, through taking that right view and applying that consciously in meditation, and also through allowing the mind to just be intuitive, to just know. And remember that the more you've done those things, the more you've assessed and checked and reprogrammed your right view, and the more you've investigated and so on, then the easier it will be for the experience to happen. The mind will tend to go down those ways. It will tend to investigate in the right way. So always remember that when your mind is purified with samadhi, and that there is this clarity and stillness, that you can trust that. You can trust that more than anything you can trust in the world. And you can trust that stillness to lead. You can allow the mind to follow that where it wants to go. So if you've done that preliminary work and the preliminary studies and contemplations and things, and the mind's purified, then you just let it go and you let it follow its own path. And then that will follow in deeper and deeper and deeper. You don't have to push it. It goes on automatic. So that's enough talking for now. Maybe if there's any questions or anything before we go, then we might do some guided meditation. I might do some guided meditation on the six senses. Okay. You're sitting quietly. Allowing the mind to find its place of stillness in the heart. And paying attention to, first of all, to the eyes. Experiencing what they're like. Physical, place, eyeballs, socket, what can you feel there? Have this perception, this mind's image, mind's idea of what the eyeball is like. And we also have this physical sensation of that region. And so in this, we have this, they sort of go together to make up this mental picture of the eye. What's that like? And then the external sense base, the sights. Even with your eyelids shut, then you can see a dim glow in this dimly lit room. And you can just see there's this kind of field. It's usually a kind of oval-shaped field. It's more clearly defined in the center and more vague and fuzzes off to the outside until it disappears into nothingness. Seems to be centered around just directly in front of where the eyes are. So what's that like? What's that sensory field, sensory stimulation, what kind of thing it is it? What field does it have? What's its flavor? And then the eye consciousness. Somehow we have this experience, the awareness, is the awareness as the internal eye, the external form, and the awareness of the thing. All interdependent. moving to the ear. Again, starting with the physical awareness. What's our ear like? You can feel it, feel the sensations there. And the ear, the external senses, the sounds, paying attention to that external field coming from all around us. It's not as clearly defined spatially as the field of eye consciousness. We can tell generally what direction sounds are coming from. You can hear the different sounds coming in the left and the right ear. You get a picture of whereabouts in the room, whereabouts spatially sounds are located, like a 3D map. And then the ear consciousness, the awareness of sounds. What's this mode of consciousness like? And then moving to the nose. Again, getting some idea of the physical. Physical nose, how it feels to us from the inside. We can also ask ourselves, where do we actually smell? Where does that actually take place? It's not quite obvious, is it? The smells, like what is, again, that external field. You can't spatialize that in the same way that either sight or sound is. More or less just appears to our nose. Has its own particular, spectrum of experience, which is quite unlike either sound or sight. And then the consciousness, the awareness of that, subjective experience. What's that like? Can you tease that out of the experience? Can you see what that's like? It's not easy to differentiate these things. Not easy to notice exactly what this is talking about. You try to just tune in and see what that aspect is like. And then to the tongue. You can feel the physical tongue and the sitting there in the mouth. And the taste, just the kind of subtle, slightly bitter residual taste of the saliva in the mouth. Again, quite different to any of the other senses. Taste is very present, very localized. Tends to be something that we are actually conscious of only occasionally. Most of the time we ignore it, and we're only when we're eating or we want to taste something are we actually aware of taste. Unlike, say, sight and sound that we tend to be aware of most of the time. It's quite a different kind of thing. And then the taste consciousness. The subjective awareness of flavor. Not the flavor itself, but the awareness of the flavor. body, awareness of soul. Physical frame sitting here, again quite different to any of the others, not localized like the others, but it's coextensive with our whole sense of who we are. Both the external stimuli, like pressure when we're sitting and so on, the internal pressures and feelings inside our body, all of these stimuli all over. So paying attention to the physical body, it has quite a definite shape. And again, this definite shape is quite different from any of the other sense fields. The object of those touches, the different kinds of stimuli, the coolness of the air, temperature is one kind, pressure is another kind, different kinds of itches and so on you have on the skin, the feedback that your body's given you about its position. It's a very complex kind of input that you're getting from the body at all times. Some of it's very obvious, some of it's very subtle, because a lot of it goes unnoticed, but we can find it when we want to. And then the consciousness, the body awareness. Knowing of all these different kinds of feelings and inputs. And finally, in looking at the mind, the most elusive of all, the one that always tries to run away as soon as we catch it. And still we can feel somehow there's an innerness and an outerness to the mind. You feel somehow that there's this inner, almost like an organ of knowing. That's almost kind of waiting. And then in relation to that is this, is the external, the object of the mind. Sometimes these objects appear as close parallels to the sense objects. So especially images. And we can imagine a picture or a shape or a face. And the way that that appears to us is analogous to the way that real sights appear in front of our eyes. We experience it in a way that's somewhat similar. Like the sight is out there somewhere. Other times we have other kinds of mental objects also come up, of course, the thoughts, the ideas and moods. It's very, very complex. Again, very different kind of thing than, say, the eye, which just has one kind of knowing, the ear just has one kind, nose, the tongue just have one kind of knowing. Body is more complex, more diverse in the kinds of things that it's aware of, but still fairly limited, comparatively. And the objects that the mind can know and the way that the mind can operate is almost infinitely diverse. And then we can step back and know all that, know, pay attention to the knowing of what's going on in the mind. Just that reflective ability to witness. And finally, we can just reflect for a few moments on the impermanence of all these things. Remember how, as we've been going through the different sense bases, that experience is always changing. I try to pin down the I experience. It's changing within itself, the I, the sights, the I consciousness. All, each thing individually is changing. But also our attention is always changing from one to the other. And our experience of sound consciousness is utterly different from our experience of sight consciousness. Completely different kinds of things. And so all the different ways that we experience consciousness all built up into this one world vision that's sort of synthesized and presented to us as if it's the world. And yet it's all from these changing, this changing network, this changing web of sensory data. Always fluctuating, always uncertain. Finally, coming to the end of the meditation, just return to that sense of knowing in the heart that we started out with. Just being aware of whatever, very simple. And in that, just take a minute to review over that whole meditation, just remembering what the different parts we went through. And reflecting on what you might have learned through that practice. Finally, dedicating the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings rejoice in the merit that we've made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Does anyone have any comments or questions about that?
How do you distinguish consciousness and its object?
Sorry?
How do you distinguish consciousness and its object? Because you have to have an meeting. See, for instance, with the nose, you have to have a smell in order to be conscious of that smell. So what's the difference between the actual smell and the actual knowing of the smell? How can you distinguish them in your experience?
You just have to investigate, that's all. I mean, there is a sense in which spatially there's like an inner and an outer. You can like feel that in your sense of awareness, that there's that feels outer, the sense object. Yeah? And the consciousness of it feels inner. So that's one way it can help. But you know, but also not to, you know, not to dream. They're not like completely independent things. Of course, it's not a sabhava or anything like that. It's just a framework to try to investigate, to try to break up, really to try to break up the compactness of experience, the wholeness of experience. You realize there's different aspects to it.
I guess you could be aware of the actual experience itself, so if you have a smell.
Mm.
The actual awareness of the smell is the consciousness. Is that it?
Mm. Yeah. And also one of the advantages of using the sense bases, I think, is because it is obviously our world of experience, so it's very easy to get very directly into experience doing that. And also because they're very different, you know, if you do that practice a few times, you can maybe find one or other or some of the sense bases that become more clear and more obvious. I mean, usually the eye is among the kind of clearest in terms of understanding the difference between the things more. So, and when you understand it in that one aspect, then you can take that and apply it in the other senses as well. So it's helpful.
What is it that knows each individual consciousness? Is it that they all culminate in the mind consciousness?
Hmm.
So the smell is known by mind consciousness?
No, it's known by nose consciousness.
Obviously, the nose consciousness, but what is it? Oh, that they're all interrelated, but they're all experienced in the mind, in a sense, because they're all internal. Experience is internal.
Yeah, I mean, nose consciousness is a part of the mind, not a part of the nose. Yeah. So, there's a difference between the actual kind of bare sense data and then the way that that's interpreted by the mind. So actually, by far, the most work is done by the mind consciousness, or done by the mind. Yeah, the kinds of consciousness that you keep them as simple as you can.
So I guess the contact happens of the three,
mm.
But then when that contact happens and the feeling arises,
mm.
And the mind is aware of it, and then it does something with it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. I'm just going to use my papers.
Patipanna